surrounding this thing, this round thing. And the way this thing starts vibrating is they have something called a forcer that's got the quartz in it also, the piezoelectric effect. It starts vibrating this hemispherical resonator, really what it is, and by creating these standing waves, you have an anode if the pick off electrode section moves, turns one way or the other, it will pick up the loss or the gain of these really sonic vibrations, although it's really being worked, used in a vacuum. And some articles say it's being done by... it's an incredible thing. It was actually thought about 100 years ago, late 1800s. Some guy took a wine glass and hit it, and he could hear this tone coming off of it. And if you listen to it in one direction, it sounds the same. But if he turned it, if he rotated it, slowly rotated it, he could hear it. It would fade out and come back, fade out and come back. So I thought that was pretty good. Now to make these things, there's only like 100 of them that have ever been launched. What you could do is experiment with it. I did it. I took a glass. I think you got to be like over 50 years old to do this, because what you need is a turntable. Well, I have an old phonograph, still working. Some people today might not have seen them, I still have it. And I put it onto the turntable and started this thing ringing. And sure enough, you could hear a tone. But as you turn it, it goes up and down, up and down. You can hear the change in it, And I turn it by actually putting it on a 33 and a third speed and drop it. Then it was going around and around. I thought, well, maybe because, it's moving in space, I didn't have it in the center. Maybe the Doppler effect or whatever. Maybe something else is causing this thing to change the tone. So I took the spindle out. You take the spindles out on the old record player. Took that out. Put it right in the middle. And you put it on a 33 and a third speed. And you could hear it. It goes down and comes up, down and comes up, depending on which way this thing is turning. And then to double check, I just put it on the highest speed, went up to 45 and then up to 78. And you could, with your eyes closed, you could listen to this, and you could I could tell which speed it's on. And meanwhile, this thing's sitting dead center. So I thought that was a lot of fun to try. And this is what this thing is doing. It's no spinning thing. It's just a vibrating thing with inside. It's really a three-piece. The forcer, which it's like a wine glass, and that's really made out of the same quartz type of material. So that the forcer gets this thing going, and then they have these pick-offs. I call them pickups, but they're really called pick-offs. Interesting. Went to a lot of websites to find this stuff. It wasn't that easy, and to really find some real detail. You kind of get jammed up. They'll give you one page, but one site I went to was the IEEE. If you remember that, you would see what the deal is with this. It's on a lot of spacecraft. In fact, it's on the spacecraft that's going up this Friday, called Juno. Juno is going to be launched by an Atlas rocket, Atlas V, the big one, with five solid boosters hooked. The five-year mission to get there. It's going to have one pass, one Earth gravitational assist, and then it's going to head out to Jupiter. We talked about this a couple of months ago, I think, on the net, and that's the one that's going to go into the polar orbit around Jupiter, make about 33 revolutions over a period of time, a year or so, and a big thing, by the way. It's all solar panel. And they've got to be big solar panels for this Jupiter's bit. Just type a gyro on grass, and that's the one that wound up landing on Eros quite a few years ago. So it hasn't been out all that long. It's a big thing now, and there's nothing to break. 99.99% reliability. You don't have to go out and service these things toward the end, but it really, they had a different series of these things that were being developed, and the one that they wanted to really use on all the satellites really wasn't ready for.
I got the speech processor turned on. A hemispherical resonator gyro. If you told me it was a detector that could measure the amount of roll in the X, Y, and Z axis, this 1/2 pound hemispherical resonator gyro is the actual forcing mechanism. In other words, if I want to steer my satellite to a new position, I'm doing a certain amount of rotation around the X axis, the Y axis, and the Z axis. This 1/2 pound resonating soup bowl, I'm going to call it, you're telling me, gives me the forcing function that forces my satellite, after I wait a significant amount of time, into the new position. Wow.
Negative.
Oh, go ahead, Paul.
Sensing. It's sensing. You know, the satellites, including James Webb telescope, will have thrusts on board. You know, it's sensing the location in space. You know, they've got half a dozen of these things on board. So I guess one is maybe doing the X axis, one's doing the Y. And, you know, usually it takes 3 gyroscopes to do things like that properly. But yeah, that's what it's doing. And then it's nice about it though. Yeah, I mean, with these, you know, with the telescope anyway, this new telescope design, you get it kind of close. The mirror can be rotated or moved. You know, in other words, Hubble is locked in, so the gyros do everything, and you have to use the gyros and these momentum type gyros also to move the Hubble to make it exactly right before it starts doing its work. James Webb, you know, these just have to get it close, and then you have two ways of moving things. You can actually move the mirror itself. It's got, you know, motors on it to move it, and then the mirror itself has actual, it's a segmented mirror type thing. I think it's got 36 of these pieces that make up the mirror, and each one has its own little actuator, and that in turn could actually move a little bit, you know, for fine tuning. So, in general, it's completely different than what you have on a Hubble. By the way, this James Webb thing, it's about the size of a 737.
Eventually a Cassegrainian-like thing, but the next step beyond Cassegrain is called a R.C. Ritchie Cretchian, I think it's pronounced. It's a more elaborate version of Cassegrain, which gives you very high fidelity, very little coma distortion and stigmatism and whatever. So it's a really fancy mirror. But in order for it to give you all that performance, the subreflector has to be in the sweet spot of the main mirror. The subreflector has to be tuned just right. Everything's got to be aligned just right to move the mirror as a way of steering where the telescope is aimed. Wow. With Hubble, you didn't stand a chance. So because there were 36 segments to the mirror on James Webb, I think you're telling me you can steer the mirror, which moves the beam, and then with the 36 segments, you re-correct for the shape of the mirror because now it's an offset-fed, Cassegrainian-like mirror. Very elaborate design. And the thrusting is really taking place with reaction control thrusters that are really transmitting something into space. And at one time, you and I were worried about whether or not...
I don't think they're going to use the thrusters that much, you know, once they're out there. There is quite a bit of fuel on board. because, you know, it goes into what you call a halo orbit. Sits out there. It really just sits out there a million miles out and follows us around. The sun doesn't really orbit us, unless you want to call it one orbit every 365 days. But it's also making like a little halo out there. It's 1 million miles out. And so it's got fuel on board to do that, to, you know, to make any kind of correction. They have, well, I guess they're called momentum gyro hubble with that. So, you know, I've got thrusters and these things to do that as well. So, and we're going to put a spacecraft in that location. There's one out there now called Herschel. I don't remember that one. That was by the European Space Agency. A little less than half the size of this thing. But that's out there. You know, that's been out there a couple of years already. So, but in fact, that might have come to the end of its usefulness. It only had, I think, about 3 years' worth of helium on board to keep the thing cool. That was all in the millimeter area. And it should be, you know, we do have other spacecraft at the L1 position. I think the ACE is one of them. The ELO is like a useless one, probably never be used. That's on a completely opposite side of the sun where planet Vulcan is, you know. And then you've got 4 and 5, they're all set, I think 60 degrees between the sun and Earth. L4 and then L5 follows us, also 60 degrees. Possible location for future satellites, but not presently used. Just 1 and 2 are the main ones. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I believe Helios is on 1. James Webb is going to be on Lagrange point number 2. And the nice thing about Lagrange point number 2 is that it's behind the Earth. Therefore, the Earth could give it some sun shading characteristic, although a million miles away, you're still going to get some sun shading. Because the Earth is an 8,000 mile diameter opaque object, optically speaking. And even with that halo orbit, I believe the Earth is a blockage to the sun throughout most of that halo orbit. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
It isn't. So what they have, when you look at this thing, you've got this gigantic platform, and here's this mirror sitting on top of that. Well, below the mirror, you've got five layers, and they're actually separated by a distance. Five separate layers, huge things, you know, the size of like, I don't know, it looks like, I'm not going to say a football field, but, you know, probably 100 feet anyway. More than that. A little bit bigger, longer than 100 feet, maybe 40 feet wide. These gigantic, they're really shades that are going to be stopping any light from getting near this thing. You know, any light on infrared scope spin, you know, that's like noise into our HF rig. Back to you, Dick.
How is James Webb powered? Solar cells or nuclear? Over to you, Paul.
That's solar. There's nothing nuclear on board. Oh, by the way, that's like the Herschel, that only had like a 3-year life. This thing's being designed for 10 years. And so that's a sure. And it's heavy, you know. I mean, you're looking at a 14,000 pound thing, you know. I'll be looking forward. You know, I hope they don't cancel it. I remember one guy saying that they might cancel it. I still haven't found anything that says they're going to cancel it, but looking forward to this thing back, you know, a couple of years down the road. 2018.
Periodically, the sun gives a burp of particles, mass ejection, mass expulsion, whatever it's called. And when those particles hit your solar cells, the single event upset, as it was called, knocked out the power supplies for a couple of satellites. One of the protection mechanisms is to know that the event is coming. You know, Helios lets you know that it's coming. I mean, I said Helios, I meant SOHO. SOHO, or a SOHO-like satellite, lets you know it's coming. And if you have enough time to aim the solar panels edgewise to the sun during the event, that's one of the protect mechanisms. With a big solar array like this on such a large satellite, have they mentioned how they're going to protect it from single event upset solar events that could damage the solar cells and the power supply? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Well, it has to do with these five layers. They're all not made of the same thing. It's layer after layer of protection. It looks like, maybe about an inch or 2 inches between each layer. Hard to tell. It's not like five layers that are like put together, like a spacesuit. It's not like they're touching. There's separation between them. So I guess that's going to help protect anything coming through. One thing good about these hemispherical resonated gyros, they're indestructible to cosmic rays or even any kind of radiation. You don't have to worry about anything like that. Like I said, they're on the Juno spacecraft. Now, the Juno spacecraft is going to go into a very high elliptical orbit around Jupiter. So Jupiter has its own, like, Van Allen belt. Super duper radiation. This thing's going to be going through it all the time. It's going to go in a couple of thousand miles off the surface, and then about 40 times the distance of the diameter of Jupiter away. Highly elliptical. But it's going to happen 33 different times. So the radiation will not affect these gyros, but electronics and all of that, I guess, is all susceptible to it. They have all kinds of protection devices built around a Juno electronics. First time ever that they're using this box to protect it. So maybe they have that on the James Webb too. Back to you, Dick.
You mentioned five layers of protective material. Is that sort of like a sun shield? Is that built into the solar cells, or is that between the sun and the James Webb? These five layers of material, is that a sun shield? How big is that, and what is it shielding? Is it shielding the whole spacecraft, or just the solar cells, or just the telescope itself? Give me a few more words on those five layers. That's a new one on me, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
You can see it. You go to Google and you go to images and you put in James Webb Space Telescope, JWST, and you're going to get about 20 pictures right off the bat, and you could pick any one of them and you could see these sets of blankets. I don't even know how to unfurl these things without wrinkling them up. It's unbelievable. I'll have to look into the solar cell deal on how that works. Picture's worth a thousand words. Picture a gigantic blanket, maybe half the length of a football field and about 40 feet wide, and then put another blanket below that, separated by about an inch or two, and then another one below that, and put five of these things, and then kind of like curve them, they look curved like a boat. And on top of that, where the mass would be, here's a gigantic 36 segmented mirror sitting on top of it. That's what this thing looks like. But we'll have to research it. How far this thing goes, is it going to protect it from who knows what? You're going to get the solar effect where the sun's going to hit it and it's going to move like a solar sail. I don't think so, but it looks big enough to be a solar sail. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of James Webb, what is its current status? Study program funded? Hardware construction begun? I think you said 2018 is a possible launch date. So, what is the current status of James Webb? If you know, Paul, go ahead.
2018. I know they're working on how they're going to open and close. I saw that on their website. big, gigantic blankets. Hooked up to all kinds of machinery to open and close it. I'm sure you've got mirrors being designed. You know the material they're going to make it out of. I think they had a beryllium thing, but made out of beryllium. But we'll see. I know the Herschel mirror was made out of out of bracelet stuff. Like you would put on a Dremel tool if you were going to use a cutting wheel or something. So I'm not sure if maybe James Webb is going to have that. But I mean, how far along are they? I don't know. I know they were pouring money into it, and it looked like a lot of people working on it. They have it looks like a bag. I counted about. I did the math. It was about 200 people standing below a mock-up of this thing. It's incredible.
Well, you said Herschel had something that sounded like an abrasive material. Was that silicon carbide? Go ahead.
Silicon carbide, same stuff you would have. Something with one of those old cutting wheels, that type of material. So they used silicon carbide, and they somehow shaped it into a mirror form. And they, you know, I guess it was lightweight and strong, and it doesn't get affected by heat, so it doesn't expand and contract. You know, the diameter is less than half of what this thing is. It's bigger than Hubble, but it's not, you know, don't forget it's not an optical thing. It's for infrared as well.
And right now, is the best thinking that Hubble is going to almost last in time for James Webb to take over?
I know they'll let it go. I did find something during the week that said they were hoping to get 7 years out of it. So I think at 7 years, that would be good. That would be, you know, right up to 2018 from now. And you'd have James Webb take over, you know, a year after that. But without it, I don't know, you won't have anything taken over. they have different kinds of telescopes all the time going up, but this is the one that you really want. They show it as this one diagram. It's going to see it much further. It looks like at least 20% further than Hubble could have seen. As far as they're going to look at the first stars that were ever put up, you know, put out when they first came on. So that's pretty good. I know the Herschel mirror is like it was roughly 3.5 meter mirror in diameter. James Webb is, you know, twice that. So a little bit bigger than twice that. Back to you, sir.
That's a lot of mirror. Was Herschel done in segments, or is that one piece? I'm guessing that was segments. And probably done by University of Arizona. Go ahead.
It was done in one piece. NASA had a piece of it. I don't know who actually did the mirror. Don't forget, it was a European Space Agency job. So the NASA was involved in it. I don't know what part they had. And, one piece. Roughly 11 and a half feet diameter. So enough to put onto an Ariane. You know, they launched that with an Ariane. What's the Ariane 5? One a little smaller than that. That came out of French Guiana in South America. That's where the European Space Agency launched their rocket. So, you've got quite a few different contractors involved in that project. I think that I have to check. I don't remember. It seemed like about 3 or 4 years ago when it went up. Trying to think when it was launched. It was launched around 2008, maybe 2009. So that's only about, maybe another year left in it before that thing quits. You know, what determines the life is the amount of helium on board that keeps the thing cold.
When you see the August issue of Scientific American 2011, there's a beautiful article about the different layouts that believing probably takes place for the multiple universes, multiverses, is now becoming a popular idea that the thing that we call the universe is just our local observable universe. And our local universe is 13 and a fraction billion years old since the Big Bang. And lots of people think that means that we can only see out 13 billion years. Well, that article says that the observable universe is 42 billion light years. We can see 42 billion light years, and we're looking at the stuff that was blasted out at various velocities, 13.7, I think it is, billion light years away. Light years, here we go, 13 billion years ago was the Big Bang. That kind of amazed me, that we're claiming 42 billion light years of observable. And that makes a little bit more sense when you look at the fact that the ultra-deep field picture that was a million-second integration on Hubble looked deeper in space than we've ever seen before, saw a whole lot of stuff we've never seen before. In that one direction where they looked for a million seconds, they saw 2,700 galaxies that have never been seen before, and some of them at huge redshifts, implying that by the Hubble constant, they're very far away. Let me drop it. And I have the impression that when they look out, if the observable universe is 42 billion light years in radius, that's how far you can see, I have the impression that the amount of material out there is not decreasing in density. So that's not the edge of our Big Bang, if you know what I mean. There's other stuff out there. We're not alone. There's multiple universes. There would have to be. Why would there be only one universe and we just happen to be in that particular one? I mean, we used to think the Earth was everything. You know, the whole universe revolved around the Earth. Then we decided that, well, we're part of a solar system. The Sun is the major thing. We thought the Sun was everything. Well, the Sun is just one star in our galaxy. Well, our galaxy is everything. We used to call that the universe. And eventually they had to call what we call the universe, the island universe, which became galaxy, because there's a local galactic group. And we thought the local galactic group was everything. Well, there's nothing beyond that. There's a whole lot of galaxies, 10 to 11 galaxies. So we've been humbled 6 or 7 times in a row. I think we're about to be humbled the 8th time. We find out this is not the only universe. Got to think big, yes, all. Thank you for all that information. Okay, now we're going to go over to the... go ahead, who is that?
One more thing from Paul.
You got it, Paul.
On a hemispherical resonator gyro, they have a... interesting when you get involved because they talk about the circuitry. I couldn't get too much information, but they do have phase lock loop connected to this thing to keep this thing resonating at the same frequency all the time. So that was pretty good. And then I like the standing wave. They did try to explain that. I read some diagrams, and they show like what the bottom of a bell would look like. When you hit a bell, you know, you look at a bell and it's round, but when you hit it, it deforms. It becomes like, I don't want to call it, and then it reverses, and now that becomes, you know, elongated, and the other part shrinks. So you wind up with these nodes and anti-nodes, high spots and low spots, all in the same spot. But it especially it tends to start to rotate around this bell. So the evolution of this thing over the years, it started back in the 70s, and it worked its way through, and it went through a couple of companies. Company really started to develop it, and then it was bought up by another company called Litton, L-I-T-T-O-N, and after they had it for a while, and it was successful with it, lo and behold, Grumman bought it, Northrop Grumman, and they're the ones that got a hold of this thing now. They're the ones that are mass producing these things. To some degree, I mean, they're highly accurate. They've even used them here on Earth. They had to create a complete vacuum inside, which is, and they could use it for putting it down wells and things like that to locate things. But up in space, you don't have to worry about it. It works perfectly in a vacuum, and of course, up in space is a vacuum. So. It's interesting to see the drawings, you know, like the bottom of a bell. Well, that's what this is like. It's the shape of that type, you know, this hemispherical shape. Back to you.
When you own an iPhone, you don't realize, but some very fancy gyroscopic like detectors in that, because you can take that iPhone and you might be looking at it with, you're looking at the photograph on the screen, and it might be a horizontal photograph, and you rotate the screen so that it's now vertical, and the iPhone knows that you've rotated it, and it readjusts the picture accordingly. You've probably seen a lot of advertisements doing that, and quite a few guys probably own one of these things. There's some pretty fancy gyros in there that are sensing motion and direction of motion and rotation. So there's minor versions of what you're describing in miniature form in those motion detectors that are inside of some of our modern chunks of electronics.
And they're called sonic. I think they're sonic generators, very similar to this.
Yeah, but I presume the way this hemispherical resonator gyro works, I presume the motion creates a kind of a variation to that standing wave. In other words, the nodes and the antinodes move in a characteristic way, and the characteristic way that they move does some cross-coupling to other detectors, and that tells them what direction it's being rotated and how fast it's being rotated. I'm making some guesses here. Am I close, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I agree. That's pretty much what I believe is true. But to get to that next step, to actually see this thing mounted onto it, you know, the diagrams of it mounted onto a spacecraft. You know, they'll show you pictures of the spacecraft, the Juno spacecraft, or where it's located. To see it actually mounted and physically attached to something, that, you know, that's a little hard to get. I think you'd have to go, you know, the next step, that you have to belong to these different societies or science societies or whatever to, you know, they want passwords and everything to get in. I'm not sure. It sounds like what you're describing. That's what I wanted to see. I wanted to see a little bit more detail. I wanted to see more detail on the electronics, an actual physical picture instead of drawings of the resonator in three parts that I described, the forcer and pick up device. You know, it sounds like that, but I don't know. I don't know if the rest of it's top secret, or maybe you have to work with Northrop Grumman or something. I'm not sure. Back to you, Dave.
In order for you to find this information that you found, Paul, do you remember approximately what search words you used?
Well, I started off with the James Webb Telescope and looked for, I think it was inertial guidance system, and they show you the star trackers. They have star trackers on board. They have sun trackers, you know, different things that they use. And then they talk. They said they have the HRG. Okay, what's HRG? Put that into Google. And put in HRG gyro or whatever. So one thing popped up something, and one thing led to the other, and eventually I figured out what it was. And, other sites confirmed that, and sure enough, you're putting in hemispherical resonator gyro all over the place, and how does it work, or theory of it, you know, theory of hemispherical resonator gyro, and you're going to bring up all these sites, and eventually some of them actually brought me back to the James Webb Space Telescope, so I knew I had the right one. Back to you, there.
Good stuff, Paul. Keep up the good work. And I think the space hardware, that's just a flash in the pan. That and computers and wireless products, I think these concepts are going to catch on. That's left-handed humor. Okay, now we're going to go into the slightly deeper material. Wesley has given us an interesting set of questions. I'm going to start off with the first one or two of them, and that is, Wesley wants to know, when it comes to building an anechoic chamber, and this is true pretty much for whether it's an acoustic anechoic chamber or a radio anechoic chamber, many of the chambers, the design of the absorptive material on the walls to make sure there's no echo, that's what anechoic means, lack of echo, many of those absorbing materials are made in pyramid form. In other words, there's a whole bunch of four-sided pyramids of the lossy material. And why are they in the pyramid form? Let me drop. And in most cases, Emerson Cumming was one of the big manufacturers. B.F. Goodrich was another. What Emerson Cumming did was to take polyurethane foam, put carbon granules in it so that it became a resistive, lossy material, and then there's two or three major styles of radio-absorbing materials that that Emerson Cumming makes. One of them is the pyramid material. Another one is the multi-sheeted flat material. And in each case, you got to decide, how do you absorb a wave? Let me think about that. If I'm standing in front of a storefront window, I'm on Main Street and I'm looking into a store window, and between me and the thing that's behind that window is a chunk of glass. And we would like that glass to be thoroughly transparent. And it is 90-some-odd% transparent. But if you look carefully, you can see a reflection off of that glass. You know that the glass is there because of the reflection. So that not all of the light penetrates the glass. A small percentage of it comes from free space, hits the glass, and reflects off the glass. Why is that? Why can't we make glass that has no absorption, that has no reflection? And yes, you can do that at certain frequencies. These exotic coatings that you put on the lenses on a telescope or on a fancy camera come very close to making the reflection go to zero. And how do they do that? And why is there a reflection in the first place? And here's my take on that. Once that wave is transmitted into free space, whether it be optical, infrared, far infrared, microwave, millimeter wave, radio, HF, whatever, that wave sees free space. And lots of people have said that free space has got an impedance of 377 ohms. What that means, we could go into a discussion on that one for a long time. But the free space, call it a very low density plastic, if you know what I mean, it has that particular impedance. Almost anything you put in that free space, whether it be a sheet of plastic, a sheet of polyethylene, a sheet of glass, whatever, that you think is reasonably transparent, let me drop. Your transparent materials, with rare exception, are going to have a different spatial impedance than free space. Your chunk of glass might have a dielectric constant of 3, or it's got an index of refraction of 2.5. In other words, the velocity of propagation of the signal through the glass is different than through free space. So whenever a signal encounters a different medium, is always going to be a reflection. To boil it all down, and when we're talking about free space and we're talking about a sheet of glass, we're talking about three-dimensional analysis. You can boil it all down to one dimension, and the physics is the same. When you boil propagation down to one dimension, it is a transmission line. A coaxial cable is a one-dimensional equivalent of free space. You and I might own a particular piece of coaxial cable that we call 50 ohm impedance. In other words, the center diameter and the outer diameter have a certain ratio. The dielectric material you put between the two has a certain dielectric constant. You combine those into a particular formula, and you know what the characteristic impedance of the cable is. Characteristic impedance means that if the cable was infinite in length, you could put your ohm meter, your network analyzer, you could put any instrumentation on one end of that cable. And on that particular brand of cable, that particular model of cable, no matter how you measure it, you would think it's a perfect 50 ohm resistor if the cable was infinite in length. And the reason we talk about infinite length is because beyond a certain length, the loss of the cable becomes significant, and or if there really is something at the far end of the cable that's creating a reflection, if the cable is infinite in length, at the speed of light, it's going to take an infinite length of time for that reflection to come back to you. After you've connected your ohm meter to it, you're not going to see that reflection because you don't live long enough. Therefore, you think it's 50 ohms.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You really make a piece of cable 1 foot long, and let's assume now it's a piece of air dielectric cable. And because the speed of light is roughly 1 nanosecond long, if I put a pulse of energy into one end of the cable, and the far end is a open circuit, the signal travels down the cable for that 1 foot, takes 1 nanosecond to get to the end. It sees an open circuit. There ain't no more 50 ohm cable. Now the impedance beyond that point, as far as the cable is concerned, is essentially infinity. infinity is a great big reflecting object, so the signal reflects back to you, takes another nanosecond to get back. So the round trip time of a 1 foot length of cable, air cable, is very close to 2 nanoseconds. So if I put an ideal ohm meter across that cable, I would measure exactly 50 ohms, but only for 2 nanoseconds. After 2 nanoseconds, that reflected signal came back to me. It gave me information that the far end of the cable is an open circuit, and all of a sudden my 50 ohm reading will jump up to infinity. So if I had a very fast ohm meter, and it's called a time domain reflectometer. A time domain reflectometer, you could call it an extremely fast ohm meter. And for the first 2 nanoseconds on that particular cable, I will measure 50 ohms. So with the time domain reflectometer, I can measure the impedance of a cable, even though I don't have an infinite length. Okay. Now, you realize that an open circuit at the end of the cable is a reflection. I can put a short circuit on the end of the cable. I get the exact same amplitude of reflection, but now it's reversed in phase. A short circuit, or any impedance that I put on the end of a cable that's lower than 50 ohms, is going to invert the signal. Higher than 50 ohms, I'm going to reflect the signal in phase. So, depending on the polarity of the signal that comes back, and the length of time it takes to come back, and the amplitude of what comes back...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
With the proper use of a time domain reflectometer, which really is a radar inside of the cable, I'm transmitting a very brief pulse down the cable, and I'm measuring whether or not I see anything coming back toward me. If there's any perturbation in the cable, its diameter changes, its impedance changes, its velocity factor changes, I've got a termination on the end that's not a perfect 50 ohm resistor, it's lower than 50 ohms or higher than 50 ohms, it's got a shunt capacitor, a shunt inductor, all of these things change the reflected signal in a very characteristic way. And if you're smart enough to measure the amplitude and phase angle of what comes back, in theory, you know the exact characteristic of what was the termination on the end of the cable. That's a very handy piece of information. But as you can tell, anything other than 50 ohms is going to give you reflection. If I suddenly have 1 foot of 50 ohm cable, and I put beyond that 1 foot of 70 ohm cable, I can do that. I can, solder them together with the right kind of connectors and whatever. And so by properly analyzing the time domain reflectometer, I will first see that pulse going down the cable. When the 50 ohm impedance cable suddenly turns into 70 ohm, a small amount of that pulse is going to reflect back. And the magnitude of the pulse and the polarity of the pulse lets me know that I suddenly jumped to 70 ohms. Now, some of the signal goes through that junction and proceeds down the 70 ohm cable and now looks at the short circuit, open circuit, 70 ohm load, 50 ohm load, whatever I put on the end of the 70 ohm cable. And if it's other than 70 ohms, that's going to create another reflection. And now that reflection comes back, hits the transition between 70 and 50, a little bit of that reflects back toward the load, and some of it proceeds forward. Properly analyzed.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
If I'm smart enough, I can now, you put all of this network into a black box. You've got a 1 foot of 50 ohm cable, 1 foot of 70 ohm cable, and some kind of a crazy short circuit or open circuit or crazy termination on the end of it. If I'm smart enough in analyzing the nature of all of those reflections I get on that TDR, with rare exception, I can figure out exactly what's in that box. How many feet of which kind of cable? How far downrange is the transition? How far downrange is the termination? What's the nature of the termination? And so on. All of that information is there if you're smart enough. But as you can see, absorbing a wave, in the case of one-dimensional, once I launch that wave into a 50-ohm cable, that wave wants to see nothing but a pure 50-ohm resistor from there on, whether it be another infinite length of cable on the rest of it after the 1 foot, or whether I put a perfect 50-ohm termination. That wave, if you want no reflection, it must see nothing but 50 ohms. So now let's go back to free space. Let me drop. In the case of free space, anything but 377 ohms is going to give you a reflection. That beautiful piece of glass that you've made nice and smooth, and you've made it out of just the right materials and whatever, you've tried to make it transparent. It is 90-some-odd percent transparent, but there's always a reflection on that forward surface. Now, one of the things that we've learned throughout all of these crazy discussions we've had on the TechNet is that if I wanted to transition between 50-ohm cable and 70-ohm cable, if I did it with a sudden jump in impedance, as you can tell, you're going to get a reflection. However, if I very slowly taper the cable, if I change the diameter of the semiconductor so that I slowly taper from 50 ohms to 70 ohms, and if I do it slow enough in ohms per wavelength at the frequency I'm operating at, the signal never gets a chance to reflect. And depending on, there's some nice mathematics you can go to if you go to the right book that tell you how fast a taper you can use for how much reflection you're willing to tolerate. If I wanted all reflections to be 60 decibels suppressed, in other words, I want all reflections to be 1/1,000,000th of the power that I'm sending down the cable. That's what 60 decibels of reflection coefficient means. Let me drop. As severe as that request is, it's in some circumstances a reasonable request. You go to the right mathematics, it'll tell you how fast you're able to taper between 50 ohms and 70 ohms so that you obey this reflection coefficient requirement of minus 60 dB reflection coefficient. And maybe the answer is you taper 1 ohm per wavelength. So you slowly taper from 50 to 51 to 52 to 53 during each foot going down that cable, so to speak. You taper slowly enough and the signal will not reflect. If you're now trying to put a termination in free space, how do you do that? I want all of that signal propagating through that chamber. When it hits the wall, I want the material on the wall to absorb all of that signal and not reflect back. Well, I could, in theory, start off with extremely low density foam for the first, let me pick a number, 3 inches of thickness of the stuff that I'm putting on the wall. I'm putting multiple layers of stuff on the wall. And the outer layer, the one that's closest to the air in the chamber, I make it out of an extremely low density foam. You can easily buy foam at 2 pounds per cubic foot, but there's aerogels and other kinds of foam that are much, much lower in density. I can start off with a very low density foam, then slowly taper to the next level of the next sheet is going to be a slightly higher density of foam, and then a slightly higher density of foam, and then the foam has got some resistive particles in it, and with a whole bunch of layers, I can slowly taper from 377 ohms into something that's got my lossy material, my carbon granules into it, and I can absorb all of that signal. And they do sell a material, the Emerson Cummings material company sells something called AN79. I've used that stuff. It's got 6 layers to it. When you look at the edge of this flat sheet of material, it's got 6 layers, and you stick your ohm meter sideways into each of the
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And on the outer layer, the one closest to the air, so to speak, you'll measure a very high number of ohms. And as you go to the layers that are closer and closer to the back end of this stuff, where there is a sheet of metal, by the way, aluminum foil, you'll notice that the impedance gets lower and lower. What they've done is to choose sheets that are, about 3/8 of an inch thick or so, maybe a little bit less than a 1/2 inch thick, and they've chosen layers of material that have just the right resistivity so that when you marry them together as 6 sheets, you follow what's called the binomial taper. It's a mathematical stepped equivalent similar to a Gaussian-shaped curve, and so you're doing a very characteristic taper of impedance so that the reflection from the front end of that material at the rated frequency is 40 dB down. Whatever power you put into this material, this flat material, the reflection is going to be 40 dB weaker than what you put in. Okay, so I can do it by slowly tapering the layers, and then I do it with flat material, but that's an extremely expensive process. Emerson Cummings a long time ago, and I think they invented it, but maybe they didn't. They invented a much simpler technique, the pyramid taper technique. Let me drop. In the case of a pyramid taper, you got a whole bunch of these pyramid-shaped, lossy material structures on this great big sheet of material, which usually is in a 2-foot square. And picture the signal coming in at normal angle to this sheet of material. I've got a flat phase front about to hit the material. And what does it hit first? It hits the sharp points. If my particular 2-foot sheet of material has got 20 individual pyramids on it, my phase front hitting it first hits the 20 sharp points. And as that phase front proceeds further into the material, what it sees is the sharp points are becoming slightly wider and slightly higher. Because my phase front is a sheet of analysis, so to speak, as if it was a sheet of paper, and my sheet of paper is proceeding into these pyramid-shaped devices that are on this reflective, on this absorptive material, and the pyramids are slowly getting to a bigger and bigger area on my sheet of analysis as my sheet of analysis proceeds into the material. You can see that by geometry, I've created a taper, because at first, there's very little area of the absorptive material touching my phase front, and as that phase front proceeding at the speed of light goes deeper into the material, the amount of pyramid it sees gets larger and larger in area. That's one way of looking at it. So the overall phase front sees a tapered impedance. It's seeing little lumps of impedance, those sharp points, but if those points are close enough together in wavelengths, the fact that they're individual points, the wave may not be able to resolve those details. Let me drop. So a sharp point is a poor man's equivalent to building a tapered material. That's one way of analyzing it. Another way of analyzing it is that my signal sees the flat side of a pyramid, and it glances off it at a amazing angle. It bounces off of it and goes back to, from pyramid number two back to pyramid number one. So the signal is hitting the flat side and zigzagging back and forth as it goes down into the valley between the pyramids. That's another method of analysis. Which one of those is the dominant phenomena? That's a matter of what wavelength you're using and which particular material you've chosen. But either method of analysis works. So you have to slowly taper the impedance of the material if you don't want a reflection. In the case of the coatings that you put on lenses, there you choose a material that has just the right dielectric constant, that it represents a quarter wave coupling plate in between material number one, which is free space, and material number two, which is the glass of your lens. And if you take the product of those two impedances, let's call it, take the product of the two, take the square root of that, and you end up with the right material. Let me give you an example. If I had a 50-ohm antenna, and I had a 25-ohm transmitter, and I want to create an impedance match between the two, if I take 50 times 25, and I take the square root of that, I think the answer is something like 37.5. So in other words, if I have a quarter wavelength of transmission line in between my 25-ohm transmitter and my 50-ohm load, at least at that frequency where the transmission line is a quarter wavelength long, I will get in a perfect impedance match. It's
repeater, timeout, cancel.
My 37-ohm piece of cable in between the two is the geometric mean between those two impedances, and at least at that one at that one frequency, all the reflections work back and forth in such a way that there is no final, in the final reflection, there is no overall reflection. All the reflections cancel each other. If you go step by step to figure out what's going on, it's a little bit complicated. Take my word for it, that a quarter wavelength of material of the geometric mean impedance will give you a perfect impedance match at that wavelength. So a simple quarter wave of optical material on your lens at one wavelength gives you essentially no reflection. Let me drop. Now, the really fancy lens makers and telescope lens mirror makers, mostly talk about lens, will not use just one layer of material. They use multiple layers of material to try to make the quarter wave impedance matching phenomena have more broadband characteristics to it. By the same token, the 37-ohm piece of cable that I used in my example to match 25 ohms to 50 ohms, I could synthesize the 37-ohm piece of cable by little bitty pieces of 50-ohm and 70-ohm cable. You combine little pieces of 50-ohm and 70-ohm cable in just the right combination, little pieces, I can synthesize a piece of 37-ohm cable, and if I do it just right, the whole circuit becomes more broadband. Take my word for it, a little bit complicated. So that gives you a little bit of a feeling for why are the pyramids of an anechoic chamber, the reflecting material, why are they usually pyramid-shaped? Now, the pyramid shapes are great for a signal that hits the material at a normal angle. At a grazing angle, the stuff is terrible. And I ran into that problem when I was doing that work at the Benfield anechoic facility at Edwards Air Force Base. There we had a bunch of pyramid-shaped absorber material sitting on the floor, and the sharp pyramids were aimed at the ceiling, 70 feet up. In the middle of the chamber was an airplane that was sending out a signal, and the signal was being transmitted from the airplane at a grazing angle toward the floor. And now that grazing angle was not hitting that pyramid material in the desirable direction, hitting the sharp points first. The grazing angle of transmission was hitting the flat sides of those pyramids. And although the material on the floor is called absorber, it was reflecting a lot of signal. An amount of signal that was being reflected was not a tolerable amount for the test that was being constructed.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So the absorbing material on the floor of the Benfield anechoic facility during the test of a B-1B bomber airplane in 1989, when I was involved in that project, the absorbing material on the floor was reflective, and it was creating echoes way beyond a tolerable amount. It took me a long period of time, but I eventually convinced the engineers working at that chamber, who worked for Rockwell was the prime contractor building this $63 million chamber, I had to convince them to remove the absorber off the floor in order to make the chamber more absorptive. Of course, those words sound conflicting, and they thought I was crazy. But after me screaming and hollering for a while, I eventually convinced them to do it. And when they removed the absorbing material off the floor, the signal from the airplane struck the bare concrete floor at a grazing angle, bounced off the floor, went over to the wall at a near normal angle, and got absorbed. The whole chamber became less reflective, more absorptive, when they removed the absorbing material off the floor, because they were looking into the flat sides of that absorbing material. So, absorbing material, pyramid shape, works like a charm, but only at certain angles for the signal hitting it. Now, if you're trying to build a chamber where you're doing radar cross-section measurements, and now some of the signals are going to be hitting the walls of your chamber at a grazing angle, is an entirely different kind of material that you use. I call it ridge ram. In other words, the pyramid-shaped material, if you make it pyramid shape in one direction, in the X direction, but you make it like furrows of a farmer's field in the Y direction, you now end up with a better grazing angle absorptive material. So there's a whole art and science to designing materials that absorb. So the cheapest materials that do the absorbing are simple...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The inexpensive materials that do the absorbing are carbon-loaded urethane foam materials, usually, and set up with the right geometry or with the right densities of various layers, you can make some pretty good absorbing material. The next level of absorption is to now use lossy material that has magnetic absorbing, magnetic lossy, as well as dielectric lossy. The carbon granules in the foam is a dielectric lossy material. If you use the right kind of grains of magnetic material buried into the right kind of rubber, you can now make material that is absorptive in the magnetic sense. And now if you go the next step so that you have just the right ratio of magnetic impedance and resistive impedance, let's call it dielectric constant, but if you've got the right amount of loss tangent of dielectric material and the right amount of lossy characteristic of magnetic material of just the right ratios, you can make a gray, absorptive, rubbery material that simulates 377 ohms, at least at one frequency. And now that material can be a lot thinner and very absorptive. That's the good news. To properly get that balance of that simultaneous magnetic and dielectric lossy material is an expensive process. You pay a lot of dollars per square foot of that material. So not very many materials, not many chambers have that material. On top of that, the design of that material favors a very narrow frequency range. The nice thing about the pyramid-shaped absorber is that properly used, you could build a chamber that covers 1 gig to to 20 gigahertz easily, maybe 1 gig to 40 gigahertz. To do it with the magnetic absorbing materials, to get it